He saw it as an incredible opportunity to have his own team, to coach them, and to have them believe in something bigger than themselves, to be part of something bigger. So what he did was very unique at the time, and we can forget that. He really did build something.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experience and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. The ninth of 11 children, Megan Harrington grew up understanding the value of competition and how to tell a great story. In the third grade, Megan wrote a poem that included the prophetic line, "When I grow up, I want to be a Lady Grizz basketball player at the University of Montana." Megan did attend the University of Montana to attain a communications degree, an MBA, and play for the Lady Grizz. As a Lady Grizz, Megan played for legendary head coach Robin Selvig. Rob Selvig ended his 38-year head coaching career at the University of Montana in 2016. His stats are impressive: 865 wins, 24 conference championships, and 21 times Coach of the Year. After 7 years as managing director of the Montana World Trade Center, Megan's desire to tell stories, particularly faith-based ones, commanded her to Hollywood. Here she merged her UM basketball experience with her storytelling skills, producing, directing, and co-writing The House That Rob Built, a documentary detailing the legendary career and impact of her former coach. Today on Can Do, we learn more about Megan's career path and the labor of love that is The House That Rob Built. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Megan Harrington, welcome to the show today. It's a pleasure to see you.
Pleasure to see you, Arnie, and wonderful to be with my former boss today.
In the spirit of full disclosure, I have to share that from 2000 to 2007, Megan Harrington worked with me at the Montana World Trade Center, one of the best hires I've ever had. So again, welcome to the show. And let's focus on The House That Rob Built. Why did you do this documentary? What compelled you to do it?
Well, I was an independent producer at the time. And so you're looking for stories. And I remember being at a game and thinking, that is incredible that he's coached so many, Rob, the head coach of the women's team at the time, has coached so many mothers and daughters. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting, maybe that'd be a short film. And then it kind of, you know, you move on and you're kind of hustling for different jobs and different projects. And he retires. And I know that over 100 women are coming back. He does not know that for his retirement. And that really was the launching pad for the documentary, is capturing that retirement and those women coming back. You just couldn't recreate it.
And you played for him for 4 years. You were a neighbor. You babysat for his kids. Was that a help for you, or was that a hindrance?
It was helpful to have played for him. Now, even growing up, he was Mr. Selvig. I mean, it was, you know, he never went by Mr. He was Rob, but I'd always call him Mr. Selvig. I don't feel like I knew him super well, even though he was a neighbor. He was this mythical figure that lived down the road that coached the women's team that I really wanted to play for. But having an opportunity to be part of his team, I think, was an asset in telling the story and really understanding what it meant to play for Lady Grizz, what it meant to have female role models, and what it meant to the community and being part of that. It was an asset.
Well, one of the things you can't overlook as you tell the story is the fact that he's a man coaching a women's team for all this time. He started his coaching career when Title IX first began and women's basketball started to move and women's sports started to become on equal footing with men's sports. What about that relationship? What about that chemistry is highlighted in the film?
Well, it's a really unique part of the story, actually. And even in making the film, I became aware of things that I didn't quite understand growing up in Missoula, of the uniqueness of what happened in our city and in our state. Rob played for the men's team at the University of Montana, but he didn't even know there was a women's team. So that should tell you right there where women's basketball stood at the dawn of Title IX. So he takes over. He just wants to coach women's basketball, and he treats them as athletes. And it was a very different situation and a very different time. So he was coaching women's basketball when many men probably weren't looking to that as being the aspiration. He saw it as an incredible opportunity to have his own team, to coach them, and to have them believe in something bigger than themselves, to be part of something bigger. So what he did was very unique at the time, and we can forget that. We can forget because now basketball, you turn it on, you can watch women's basketball, you see coaches of all different calibers. But think about 1978, there wasn't the following for basketball. He created something. He really did build something.
You talk about not having a big following. Didn't the Lady Grizz over those years have the third highest attendance in all of women's college basketball?
Yeah, in 1988, they had the largest crowd west of the Rockies show up for the Lady Grizz Montana State game. They were number 6 in the nation. That's pretty unbelievable when you think about, you know, this is Missoula, Montana. So it's really a story that historically has a lot of significance that I hope our state can really be proud of. And I know that I gained a lot of knowledge about what happened. Because when you're in the midst of it, you're just like, oh, this is what we do. This is what happens. People go to the women's game just as much as the men's, but it wasn't. It wasn't the norm. It was very pioneering.
Rob's a funny guy. Rob might have said half of those people were your family members.
I think he did actually say that.
He's also a very introspective guy. How did you get him to agree to be the focus of a documentary?
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. So when I called him, it was a Tuesday. I remember he had just retired. And I said, Rob, we'd like to do this documentary. Would you? And he's like, oh, Meg, you know, let me think about it for all the reasons you're saying. And it was Tuesday. And I said, okay, I'll give you a call Friday. And he goes, Meg, I mean, that's 4 days. I mean, you got to give me a little longer than that. And I was like, okay, I'll give him some space. And then I had other people peer pressure him into doing it. And then when he, just like anything that he does, when he accepted being part of it, he really opened the door and allowed us. I mean, he gave a lot of his time, but it's just not his way. You know, everything, he's very difficult interviewer also, because nothing is anything he did. It was everybody else did it, and somehow, you know, just magically it all happened. But he really opened up in ways too. So it was a gift that he did.
How does a documentary about someone like Rob Selvig get exposure? I mean, you had to raise a budget for it. You had to convince producers that this was a good thing to do. You were one of the producers. And how did that whole process unfold?
It's like a small business. It's like you're starting each film is, you know, it's its own LLC. It's its own small business. So you're starting and you're having to do a plan and raise money. And especially for somebody like Rob, I don't want to say he's not known, but he's not in the way that a Tara Vanderveer or a Geno, but he's the same caliber. So it's one of those unsung heroes, those underdog stories, and pitching it as such of like what was built here, the crowds, the community, his record alone, 865 wins, 286 losses. The fact you should know who he is, and everybody in the basketball world does. So it's a matter of bringing a story to a community, to an audience that loves sports, but just might be unfamiliar with it. So we did have to, like you said, we raised the funds, and that's difficult. It's difficult for movies in general, investors or your money back. We did go the donation route for this film. We had a fiscal sponsor so that people, if they wanted to contribute to the film, it would be a tax write-off. So there's different ways you can do fundraising for a film. And we thought for this one, that was the best route. What happened at the film festival in Missoula is where we got our distribution. It was a marketing, RTG Features, Slam Media, Five Star Basketball. He was reviewing festivals. He's a sports guy. And he's seeing that this sells out 3 times in a row. And immediately, and he's like, oh, what's this film? So he reaches out. And from there, we had other introductions. And that's what led to the deal with 1091, which is a very reputable distributor. It's a big deal that a film gets distribution. And they're a great partner for this film. And then, you know, we're in transactional phase. So it's Amazon and iTunes. And all of these different windows, when you start with this first window, affects Netflix being interested later. So that's why the transactions, the reviews, the stars, the national media, all helps you get to the next window. which is streaming in many cases for where the most eyeballs will be. So it's very much a business endeavor.
11 years ago, you were at the Montana World Trade Center and you decided that Hollywood was calling. Why did you decide to make that kind of change in your life at that point?
It really did start with jury duty. I had always been interested in film and media, and I like inspiring stories. Rudy, Hoosiers, Cinderella Man, all those stories where you leave feeling like anything is possible, and a little inspiration. I think we need that more now than ever. But I had jury duty, and it was a child abuse case, and I was just so distraught, and I had never been to spiritual direction. And I went to a parish priest, and we talked through jury duty, and then we started talking through this idea of media that I'd had in the back of my head that wasn't going away, but I really wasn't responding to. And there's a program called Act One, and it was a summer program. And so I started, you know, kind of mulling that over. And then I said, okay, I'm going to apply. And I have 10 siblings, so I'm not going to really tell many of them. You get a lot of input on whether that was a good or bad idea. And at the time, that would have been a crazy. It was crazy. But I just knew that I had to think through that, and I wasn't married at the time. And so I went through these different, you know, evaluations, and then I made the leap, which was crazy. I had a wonderful job working for you. You know, all the things that would make it seem crazy to do, and it was, but I just knew I had to go and respond to whatever was being asked of me at that time.
So now you're in Hollywood. You're taking this class. How'd your career evolve from that?
I was a non-trad intern. So their internship, so it was very humbling also in a lot of ways because I wasn't right out of college. But I went through this program and you get assigned different internships. So the internship I had, I ended up working for the company. It was a marketing company. And then Empower Pictures was my other internship. 6 months later, they had an opening for a marketing position with a feature film. So I went to work for them, and then the doors opened. Then they got a documentary. Then a new project came in. I became a production coordinator, and then I became a production supervisor, and then pitched a documentary called The Dating Project. That was the first documentary produced. And it kind of just went from there, just working, basically working your way up from intern.
Was there anyone that served as a mentor during this process? There's a lot to learn in this industry.
So the two individuals that I worked for on the documentaries, John Shepherd and Lori Balog, were the producers I worked under. And so that was a great opportunity to learn how these work. There is no way that I could have showed up. I mean, you're still learning every time you do a film. But to show up and just think that, oh, I'm just going to be a producer and produce this film, it's just so complicated. So working under them, working under those producers, was hugely advantageous in understanding, okay, this is how the business works, and you're just continuing to learn because it continues to change.
And the house that Rob built, was that the first project that you were the producer, director, and co-writer of?
Yes, that was the first one in the director role. The two previous was writer, producer.
So how daunting was that experience for you?
So it's not unlike anybody else's job in that you get into a project and you get into this phase. It's overwhelming. And for the house that Rob built, there was a little extra pressure, I think, because of what the story was, because of who it was involving, and you know, the girls that I played with, Rob, his assistant coaches, the community, there was a lot of like, oh my goodness, I really want these people to feel part of what they helped create and have everybody feel like, okay, this story was well told. And that was a little extra pressure, certainly with the house that Rob built, of making sure that people were proud of it. Certainly everybody worked incredibly hard. But they're overwhelming. A documentary, any type of story like this, because you want to do it well.
Was there any time in the process where you said, I'm in over my head, I don't know if I could make this work, I don't know why I started this?
Yeah, there's definitely those moments of, you know, you're fundraising and you're trying to raise the funds, and personally you're invested in over your head, probably doing exactly what you should not do. You know, that classic case of, okay, don't do this. And then I was doing those things financially. So there were those, certainly those moments where you were overwhelmed in the way of, but like, we got to figure out a way to get this done. And then those moments would happen where something comes in or a door opens, like the company I work for, Family Theater, saying, hey, why don't you pitch me that project? And then they come in and fund the rest of the film. You know, I think those are all the moments of struggle with anything that you do in life make it that much more rewarding when you have the opportunity to see it finished. But certainly there were moments where you're like, oh my goodness, I am in way over my head. But you got to keep your head down and keep plowing forward.
How many interviews did you do for the documentary?
I think 70. So that's the part about not having all of the funding up front is you're piecing it together. And we had the reunion and then Rob's official retirement where they did a deal at the halftime of the game. So those two things happened right away and all the players were coming in. I wish we could have interviewed everybody actually. And that was difficult of choices because people just ended up in the film because that happened to be what we were talking about. Everybody said something that could have been in there.
You couldn't have put all 70 people's comments and stories in the film. And I know initially the rough cut had to be longer than 58 or 59 minutes. So take me through the process of how you take all of this and make it into the final product.
That's a great question. And no, we could not. And it was longer. But we had learned from a previous film, The Dating Project, that started out at 5 hours, that we can't do that. We had the treatment of kind of what we thought the story outline would look. You get an edit. So the editors did their edit. Then we turned that into a paper cut. So it's words. So it's everybody, you have the whole script. And then you start moving it around. And you go, okay, well, we need this comment from this player. And you start piecing it together in that way. I think there were 28 cuts in 6 or 8 weeks back and forth from the editors to me. It's a continual refinement of what's working and what's not working. There were so many things where you went, oh, I don't want, that really should be in here. It's such a great part of the story. And it just can't be because there's not enough time or it messes with the story flow.
Well, it had to be hard on your part since you knew the subject so well. Did someone else have to help you do that?
Oh, absolutely. And I should say, like, none of this happens without a team. And specifically in the trenches was John Lewis Kayela, the editor, and John Sipody, the co-director, who I've worked with on every film that I've produced. And he's incredible. And then our composer putting the music in just took it to another level. But in the trenches, it was the three of us really just going back and forth. And the great part is they had no connection with the story in terms of knowing anything about it before they started working on it. So they were a good outside, like, that's too inside baseball. People aren't going to understand that. When I think, oh, that will be good, they're like, that's not going to work. We got to try this. It was a good collaboration of keeping each other accountable to what's going to work. Because ultimately, we wanted to tell a story that would resonate with a national audience, that if anybody watched this, they would. Not so much catering to one niche, but that niche had to be served. They had to respond and appreciate and understand. And that's why it's about the story of growth of women's basketball. I mean, it is incredible what happened in Missoula. Absolutely unbelievable. And I didn't get it to the level I get it now.
A diverse group of people have commented about this, publicly commented about this film. John Stockton, basketball legend, you know, said he and his kids watched it and thought, Rob Selvig is the kind of coach you'd want to play for. Has that been gratifying to you to see that you're reaching kind of dispersed audiences on the film so far?
Yes, and it's so funny because I haven't really had time to think about so many things because you're in it trying to figure out what next you have to do. Or how are we going to reach this? Or strategizing. And TJ Burden's been leading the marketing and distribution. And so we're always trying to figure out, okay, what else can we do? How are we going to reach this? Certainly those moments where you have the names you mentioned, you're like, wow. I mean, John Stockton to say that, that's a pretty big compliment. He's NBA all-star player, and they help. They help the film. And at the end of the day, that is also what's so beautiful is they resonate with the story. It helps our story become more national, for more people to know what happened, for more people to appreciate women's basketball and the struggles and the things that have been overcome to get where we are today. Phil Jackson just endorsed it. That's a huge deal as well. And those happened because other people, Montanans, Jim McNulty King, helped with the endorsements with John Stockton in particular and Tara Vanderveer. It's because she resonated with it. I mean, Montana resonating, the connections outside of Montana that people have greatly benefited the film because people took the time to say, I want to help. And it really does bring it to the next level. So we're very grateful for everybody. And this interview, thank you. I mean, it really helps exposure for the film.
And for our listeners, Jean McNulty King is a former Lady Grizz basketball player, and Tara Vanderveer is
the winningest coach in college basketball right now. She passed Pat Summitt at the end of the year, so just a legend. And she played at the university. She played the Lady Grizz in 1988, 8,000, close to 9,000 people, in a game that probably any Montanan who was there would remember.
We are speaking with Megan Harrington, producer, director, and writer of The House That Rob Built. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by Montana Rail Links, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers and partners. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. A project like this needs endorsements. It also needs exposure. So tell me again about what role the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival played in the growth of this project.
The Big Sky Documentary Film Festival opened our door for distribution. So there was a marketing / producer who was looking at the Big Sky Film Festival. It's a very credited festival. And he was noticing, he wasn't at the festival, but he's seeing the reviews and saying, sold out crowd, sold out crowd, sold out crowd for The House That Rob Built. So after the festival, he reached out and we started discussions about the film, his interest in the film, potentially packaging the film. And one thing led to another, and his sister company is 1091 Pictures. And so an introduction was made to 1091 Pictures, who ultimately, there were a few different distribution offers, and we did ultimately end up going with 1091 Pictures, and they've been a great partner for the film. So the film festival was the door that opened that opportunity. And that was right before the world shut down. A month, 3 weeks after, that was it.
And so what has COVID-19 done to this process for you?
You know, I'm so grateful, and I feel terrible for filmmakers who were in the midst of production that needed to finish filming. We had finished filming. We had finished editing. We were really in marketing distribution phase. Sure, it would have been great to go to other festivals and be at other festivals and be able to meet people one-on-one. But it didn't hamper our ability to keep the project moving forward because we were in a phase that allowed for remote work. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. Again, I feel terrible for the filmmakers who weren't in that position because it was a big blow.
What part of your education, background, experience helped you the most in managing all of this?
That is a great question. And working for you at the Trade Center and the trade missions that we went on and the organization of that and working with different companies and different personalities and different businesses and having to put together a program and an itinerary and follow up, it's all organization. It's all mapping out how things are supposed to come together, when they're due. So I think the Trade Center was a great training ground for translating that into the film world. Definitely.
You're focusing now on faith-based films. Do you think that your career is going to maintain itself in that niche?
The company I work for was founded 70 years ago by Father Patrick Peyton. He coined the phrase, the family that prays together stays together. But his goal was family and faith-based content. And that really is where my heart is, where a family could go to a movie and like The House That Rob Built, you could enjoy with your whole family. I really want to stay in that zone of content that my nieces and nephews could watch is important to me. And the faith element is as well, but faith may be implicit or explicit. The House That Rob Built isn't, quote, a faith film. It's just a beautiful story about something wonderful that happened in a place you may have never heard of, but it's a true story, and I love those as well. So I do want to stay in the faith and family, particularly those that you could watch with all members of your family.
So you're a storyteller now. Tell me a story about making this documentary that either startled you, surprised you, or, you know, elated you.
There were a number of moments, so I'll call on a couple. When we were interviewing Rob Jed Heathcote. You know, he's 90 at the time, I think, when we interviewed him. National champion, Coach Magic Johnson, were at his home. His wife, they were just so welcoming. But he was talking, and it is in the film, but when he said that Rob, he thinks he could have played professionally if he hadn't hurt his knee. And I remember that striking me as one of those moments where I thought, what if he hadn't hurt his knee? The worst moment, probably, of his life at the time for an athlete is to get hurt, and especially if he was in the trajectory to be a professional athlete. Turned out to be the greatest gift to hundreds of women, to a town, to the sport of women's basketball. I mean, it changed the course of his life, and at the time, probably for the worse in his mind, but I couldn't help but think, I mean, talk about how you don't understand what's going on until you look back and understand what's being weaved. So I remember that moment. And also when his wife had said it was difficult when players didn't get into the game for him. I think that's a unique aspect of a coach. He's got a lot of pressure, but still, being an athlete, understand what it means to be part of a team, even a big win, that would kind of stick with him of like, I wish everybody could have got in. And I think that tells a lot about him. And I was not surprised that he would be, but I thought that told a lot about his character.
You're captain of the Lady Grizz. You scored 27 points against Gonzaga, which was a great game, probably the highest you scored in your college career. You're looking forward to a great season, and you get injured. What did you do to recover from all of that?
I had played behind Skyla Sisko, incredible mentor in terms of basketball and understanding, and taught me so much. And so you're getting your moment to, okay, I'm going to be starting, and you know, things are going, it's a bad season because a lot of people have been injured, but I remember that game because it was the Montana State game, and it really was devastating because it's the end. You know, it's the beginning of your conference season, but it's the end of your conference season, and you're losing a year. And I think it helped me in the way of, in the future, if something like that happened, to be able to handle it better initially. And I think I was very bummed out, to say the least, and realizing in the future, if that happens, you know, how I want to approach it right from the get-go. And it took a little bit to bounce back, but it was a reminder of how you need to accept those setbacks. But it is devastating.
During your playing days, you were known as a very fierce competitor. How fierce do you have to be in the movie industry these days?
Fierce is a good word. Perseverance, I think, may be the thing you really need. You need to be fierce but also with grace. And I think Rob showed that too in the way that he won and lost. He was gracious in both. And I think that's how you have to approach work in general, is be fiercely competitive, but also try to get the best out of those that you're working with and try to approach things in a way that's team and collaborative. I don't, like, it's not for me climbing up this ladder to pull everybody down as I'm going up. All boats rise, and to be part of a team is much more, I appreciate that much more than just out for myself. But perseverance is absolutely needed. I think that's needed in anything in life, but certainly in the film world, you need it.
You had a degree in communications, you had an MBA, you had work experience at the World Trade Center. But in some ways, your competitive sports career prepared you equally, if not, you know, more for working in Hollywood.
Oh, absolutely. Sports prepares you for life. Prepares you, like we talked about, setbacks with injuries. You talk about perseverance. You talk about giving more than you think you have. You talk about having to work as a team. You talk about goals and reaching an end goal and getting everybody towards a vision and moving towards this, in this case, an end product. It's all related to sports and whatever your activity is, whether it's basketball or band or music, those things where you're part of something that requires you to give, to be more selfless, to be more goal-oriented towards a common vision. For me, that was sports, and it was invaluable.
So you spent 10, 11 years in Hollywood. You're spending some time back in Montana now. There's a burgeoning film industry here. They're filming Yellowstone. They're filming Big Sky. What is your thoughts on our film industry and how it's growing in Montana?
Well, it was very eye-opening to come back and see all that is happening in the state. there's a lot of things, and you just mentioned most of them, and even Warm Springs Productions and the shows that they're doing. I think they may have been the initial catalyst of other things growing out from that. I don't know that for certain. I think there's a lot of opportunity and exciting to me. I'd love to be part of another project in Montana, and love that those doors are opening more for filmmakers, that we are becoming more of an attractive location for filming. So I hope that that maintains. And I know a lot of that is comes and goes with maybe depending on who's in office. But those incentives and those credits really help us compete with places like Canada, where they pretend it's Montana. So why not have it be Montana for real?
That's a good point. So for our listeners who are thinking about Hollywood, lots of people think about, I'm just going to go to Hollywood, you know, and get into the business. What lessons have you learned over these last 10 years that you want to share?
Be humble. Be ready to accept if you want to go to a place and you don't know really anything about that industry, then be ready to be humble and hungry and looking for opportunities. Be ready to put your boots on the ground and door to door. So for me, coming from Montana, going to the Act One program, which was a Christian-based program, a lot of people worked in the secular world, but that was a foundation for me to find that. I didn't know anybody when I left. So find a community. Community is very important, whatever your community is. Mine was this Act One program. I would encourage people to look at that. But whatever it is, find a community that you can go to and learn and be an assistant or be a coordinator and work to understand the industry and what you ultimately want to do. But it's just a matter of going and doing it and putting yourself in a position to be humble and to be hungry.
What's next for the house that Rob built? What happens now?
Well, his little home is moving across the country. We are working on national coverage. So right now, waiting a little bit, probably till after the NCAA, the Final Four, of looking for national exposure and national coverage. And there's been some great interest. So that's what we're aiming for. And then ultimately streaming a Netflix and Amazon to get the film on a streaming platform. And it's all just a process. We're probably in transactional for 90 days. So mid-May, looking at other opportunities. So again, just trying to pound the pavement.
Megan, it's always great to catch up with you. I'm proud of what you've accomplished, and this is a terrific project, and wish you nothing but success in the future.
Thank you, Arnie. And just thank you for the opportunity to work at the Trade Center. You were a wonderful mentor. You talked about mentors of educating and your business savvy and just the opportunities you've given students, but also those that worked for you. So thank you.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time for more essential business lessons from Can Do. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you good health and prosperity.